Beyond dream's door is where horror lies, where love may sleep with sorrowed eyes, where demons wait to greet the ones who dare not reach its darkened shores. Beyond dream's door, tomorrow dies, for demons keep not human ties. To dreamers dead and dreamers dying, souls on fire with fear of flying, falling fast beyond the door where trouble grows, and feet touch earth instead of rose. To this end some may go, a one-way trip into the coal, red hot with ash from wasted dream. Beyond the bonds that might redeem.
Junk Food Dinner from the Hole. Months ago, writer and director Jay Wolfel sat down with us and talked about his old projects, new projects, getting married, the filmmakers that inspire him, the future of the industry, the advantages of tangible media, and living and making films in the great state of Ohio. Junk Food Dinner is proud to present an interview with Jay Wolfel.
Director Jay Wolfel and have a little conversation. We covered Beyond Dream's Door way back in the salad days of episode 23, and after some communication snafus, we're finally able to sit down and talk. So first of all, I'd like to thank you for taking time out and doing this interview.
Oh sure, absolutely. Yeah. I'm glad it finally happened between all moving and shaking. You went to New York, I actually went to Ohio to then drive back to California, and then I'm about to get married, then I'll be off to Hawaii for a week of relaxation and all that stuff, hopefully.
Yeah.
And back at it. But So.
Sounds like you got a lot going on.
Yeah, I've got. My fall project was getting married. People are asking me, what's your next movie? I'm like, well, my fall project is getting married. But I have two films I've been working on for the past 2 years, both of which were shot in Ohio, like Beyond Dream's Door was. And that's the first films I've directed and made in Ohio since Beyond Dream's Door. Actually, I always wanted to go back and do another movie. But I thought that, you know, I could come out here to California and get some interest in somebody giving me money to go to Ohio and make a movie with all these great connections and things I could get back there. But especially on entry-level, lower-budget productions, nobody wanted to let their money out of the state and all that kind of stuff, so it took me many, many years. But yeah, so I shot both of these movies back to back in Ohio. One's called Closed for the Season. It was shot at an abandoned amusement park up near Medina, Ohio, which is in the kind of Cleveland corner of the state, which I knew very little about before making that movie. And the other one's called Season of Darkness, which was shot in Columbus, where Beyond Dream's Door was shot. And so I did both of those about 8 weeks apart and didn't realize it would take, you know, additionally, basically, there was a year of sort of essentially like production editing and another year since then. I edited both films too. So anyway, that's kept me very busy. And then I guess I thought I wasn't busy enough, so I'd get married in the fall too. So that's, yeah.
In the interim.
Yeah. As things started to kind of calm down a little bit. One of the films is done. Closed the Season is finished. And you think they're done and then they continue to have, you know, you've got to go through this whole process of having QC, quality control, done on your movie, and that's, you know, anyway.
Yeah. So I mean,
Part's over, but anyway, it's just going off to start to be sold, but it went to the Cannes Film Festival this year, so there hasn't been an actual finished movie to make screeners from. So anyway, that one's soon to be unleashed. That's what I've been doing, why I've been so busy.
Right. We sort of talked about Closed for the Season in emails, and said you had the premiere in Medina?
I did, yes. And probably right around the time we were talking, yeah, we went back and showed it there. We had a packed house. It was quite a fun evening. The park is completely gone now, but that little town, you know, small towns, they're kind of like what you see in the movie, and they kind of aren't. But when a small town has an industry, and that small town's industry was this park that closed 30 years ago. And so, like any kind of steel town or one-horse town, where literally whatever the main industry is goes away, of course, that has a huge impact on the community. And when that business is also happens to be not just a coal mine or something, but actually like something like an amusement park, that's a whole even sort of deeper wound or different kind of, you know, ripples that leaves behind. I told people when we're doing the movie is dedicated to the park, which is now completely gone. They've torn it down since we finished shooting. They actually halted deconstruction of the park, as they called it, while we shot the film. And then, of course, the whole economy collapsed and all that stuff. But it is almost completely gone now, except for what first attracted me to that location, which was Ferris wheel in the park has a tree growing right through the center of it, and that's now the only thing left of the park. And that was what really initially sort of hooked me, was just that image of these trees growing up through all these rides. I went with my family to Machu Picchu when I was in junior high school, and that's like that, all those South American ruins, you know, where the trees have just sort of grown up through the floors and up through the rafters and kind of cradle the kind of disintegration, sometimes speeding it up and sometimes kind of preserving it, you know, almost like gripping it, really. And so that's what impressed me about that park initially.
That's awesome. So you definitely, I mean, you were born in Ohio, and then
I was born
you lived
in Ohio
there for a while.
Yeah, I was born in Ohio when I was very young. My parents, my father taught at Ohio State University for many years, and his father taught there also. So my father went to Japan and taught for 6 or 7 months, and some of my first memories are actually of being in Japan as a little kid. So I was lucky to get to travel with them and to do a lot of traveling. But yeah, until I moved to Los Angeles right after Beyond M's Door, I was born and raised in Columbus. Was, you know, I stayed in that same house when I went to school, even. It was all the schools, even through college. And that house is in the movie also, and it is actually in Season of Darkness too.
Nobody ever got killed here. It is this place that died. It is the evil, forgetful world that killed it. And that is far worse. When this boat floated, this is what you'd see when you look back to shore. Now tell me, who would want to kill something like that? But that's a story for old people, and that's none of us. So, would either of you like to make up a story? Like maybe when the fabled lake monster attacked the boat.
You don't really think we're gonna fall for that, do you?
I know why this place is so creepy. It was meant for people, families, to be together having fun. It's not supposed to be alone. I mean, don't people want to have fun anymore? It's like a lost toy or a broken doll, only worse.
And you know something about lost toys, don't you, Christy?
The world outgrew this place.
Now that's the only real and new story here. Happens every day.
That's cool. So you definitely feel that Ohio connection. Is that why you wanted to go back and make these last two films in Ohio?
Yeah, well, the location, you know, the Chippewa Lake Park was just such a unique, you know, there's probably, I don't know how many abandoned amusement parks there are, but I mean, it's not that many, and each one has its kind of unique thing about it, and so that was like a one-of-a-kind location, which, if you built it, it wouldn't be as good.
Yeah.
You know, if you did have the money to build it, it wouldn't be as good unless you could build it and let it disintegrate for, you know, have it open for 100 years and let it, like, rot for 30, then you'd get the production look we had for that movie. And Season of Darkness was, so that was like, there was no, you know, I had no connection to that place. The producer, Jay Ellison, had been a student of mine briefly and had moved out here And he was from that town, so that's what made that movie happen, was his production company. Okay. And just that opportunity to make that. But I had no idea. You know, I just pitched him, wow, there's this park I'd love to make a movie in. He was like, oh, my God, I'm from there. If you make that movie, you got to let me help you. And I was like, well, you know, be careful what you wish for. And we found out that we could, in fact, shoot at the park. And I said, I want to, you know, make sure we can shoot there before I write this, because I don't want to, you know, if I wrote it, there's no other place it could be made. And it would just never get made, so I'm not going to write it unless we can make sure we shoot there. Season of Darkness was developed originally as a, there were a number of treatments, very long, single page, like 35-page, single page treatments done for our original distributor, who we ended up suing and getting a lot of money from. Well, not a lot, but we got money from. But part of the process after Beyond Dream's Door was that we'd make another movie, obviously. We developed all these treatments, and one of the treatments was Season of Darkness. The distributor kept saying, we'll do this kind of movie, and I would get, so they'd, for example, they were like, I'll do like a dark, really dark comedy, really dark, darker the better, I love it. So I wrote this treatment called Night of the Babies, which is about aliens essentially like making all the babies on the Earth essentially like deadly, and making them all crawl to these central locations where the aliens will come to then harvest the babies and eat them. And Criswell from Plan 9 from Outer Space features in the movie because he's a prophet who predicted this would happen, and he's frozen himself and all this stuff. So I gave them that, and they were just like, you know, oh, it's too dark, it's too weird. So everything was like that. No matter what it was always all. And so they're like, oh, Beyond Dream's Door, you know, it's all about, you know, what's real, what isn't, and that's what you really do best. So give us something like that where you can't tell what's real and wasn't. So I wrote this thing, and they're like, oh, man, I couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't. I didn't get it. So, you know, that was the original thing. So it was always written around. Season of Darkness was written around Ohio locations. And so although it could have been done someplace else, it just seemed, you know, right to go back there and do that because that's where it was conceived to be shot at. I mean, I took a class with several of the people who helped make Beyond Dream Store originally, these summer workshop classes, and the instructor was very big on writing for a location you could make the movie in, because independent people, he felt, and students wrote for locations they didn't have, and so then you're out trying to pretend you're in the Himalayas or something, and it just is awful, you know. So to write for some place you could go to and make it about a sense of place and all this, and so that, I think, was really good schooling for, certainly for anybody who's a regional filmmaker, is to really know what's in your region and take advantage of it rather than pretend you're not there. There's a filmmaker in Ohio who's still making movies there who pretends his movies aren't set in Ohio, and they just doesn't really work. But so I want to, you know, get into sort of bashing that. But anyway, that's kind of why those two ended up. It just seemed like the right place to go, and I wanted to work with some of the people who still live in Ohio too, and so that was connected. But there's a old and handy Indian caverns which I wanted to shoot in for part of it, and we did go down there and shoot there. They were very nice, let us shoot there, and several graveyards. Although the graveyard we ended up shooting in was different than the one I intended to shoot in, because Woody Hayes has subsequently died since I originally wrote the script, and he's buried in the one cemetery, and they like didn't want anybody interfering with traffic to Woody's grave.
Yeah, hallowed ground.
Yeah, I was like, oh, well, so I snuck a shot in there anyway, not of Woody's grave. I was like, oh, it's not why I want to shoot there.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I, you know, I found new locations in Ohio I never, you know, knew were there, even though I originally planned on it. But there's like the Olmatangi Walk Bridge and the Park of Roses and various places that the thing was always just sort of structured around.
That's cool. Oh well, yeah, I mean,
we shot at the Field of Corn in Dublin. I didn't even know that was around. I was like, oh, it's perfect for this escape sequence. They should run through a field of statuesque corn, which then turns into the graveyard statues, sort of. It's, you know, he's running past this. I've shot in a number of locations in the Weird Ohio book. Somebody, fiance's family member, gave me that for Christmas. I'm like thumbing through it, going like, oh, here's the Clintonville Ravine, which is now called the Gateway to Hell from Beyond Dream's Door, and here's Chippewa Lake Park, and here's the Dublin cornfield. And
yeah, it's funny. I mean, I shared this with you before, but when when my friend brought Beyond Dream's Door over, he had found the VHS.
And, okay. Where did he find it?
He found it in New York and brought it back to Ohio.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, you know, we got to watch this, you know, like, just based on the cover and the description and stuff. So we threw it in and we were watching it and I was like, man, I swear that's the ravine. That looks exactly like the ravine. And that looks like the library and like all this stuff. And then we got online and found it out. So it was really kind of a mind blower. And I thought that was really awesome. So
it was maybe still is, I don't know, in North Campus News for years. Right there on campus at 24-hour video store.
Mm-hmm. North Campus Video.
Yeah, North Campus Video, which I've always affectionately called the Sleazoid Video.
Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah. I love that place. Yeah, 24 hours a day, it never closes.
Yeah.
It has nothing like that in L.A. even. Anyway, it was in there for a while. They used to have like a little thing sort of, they never really put the whole Made for Ohio thing on it, so I always wondered about people from campus like renting that thing, going like, you know, oh, crap, that thing's happening right outside my door.
Yeah.
That kind of experience happens in L.A. sometimes when I saw Transformers, when I was unfortunate enough to see Transformers. I'm watching it, and I saw it in a theater I don't usually go to in sort of Glendale or someplace, and I could chuck the movie happened like 15 minutes from that theater, and it was just kind of freaking me out. It's like, I didn't know this whole movie, I was in the neighborhood where the movie was shot.
Yeah, when I had only been to New York once before, I ended up moving up here, and when I came, everybody's like, oh, what do you want to do? And I was like, I just want to go to the Columbia campus and take a picture of the opening shot of Ghostbusters, and then, you know, I don't care what else we do, so.
Yeah, after that, I've been here.
Yeah, exactly. I can see, you know, I can see buildings from here, I'm good.
Yeah, so that's funny. Yeah, I mean, Beyond Your Store was certainly written, you know, around specific, those tunnels under Ohio State. I heard about those. I never really got to explore those. I mean, part of, like, making movies is sort of, like, get to do things, you know, playing house isn't a good term, although sometimes it's like that. But, oh, man, it'd be cool to get in the old Tangie Tunnel, you know, the tunnels under Ohio State. And, you know, if we make this movie, we could get permission and actually get in there. And then we got in the sewers downtown. They let us shoot in those. And so, I mean, I'd spent, you know, there's a creek or crick. Ravine, whatever you want to call it.
I think
I live on this Brookie Court is the house I grew up in largely. We lived on campus for a bit, but mostly Brookie Court. And there's a brook behind it. And if you walk down that brook, which I did with several of my friends, you can go down and basically you kind of go under what used to be Old Tangie River Road out into the river. And so I, you know, spent some time roving around through those tunnels and stuff like that. I was never like into spelunking, but give me a tunnel with some water and rocks on it, and I'll go through it and see what's in there.
Urban spelunking.
Yeah. There was, before urban archaeology was called that, I was kind of fascinated in that. And of course, that's a big appeal for Close to the Season, for that matter, is it's kind of an urban archaeology movie.
The story of a girl who wakes up in an abandoned car in an empty park, doesn't know how she got there, and then has giants and monsters chasing her. Well, that's a good story if you like that kind of thing, but real?
Help me.
I don't think we're going to be able to get out of here.
I don't think so either.
Let's go on all the rides, do all the things we can.
What, bring this place back to life?
Live out the stories to kill them off, so to speak.
What makes you think you can kill me?
Do you really think that fighting and struggling will save you?
Was making film something you always wanted to do, or did you kind of fall into it, or?
I sort of fell into it. It was something I did. It was nothing I thought I would do as a profession, which is, you know, to be called like a film, you know. To have somebody ask you about your film career is always a little bit staggering because you're like, is this really enough of a moneymaker to be called a career? It just always seems like, I mean, you know, I think, I hope not many people grow up with the idea that, you know, you direct a movie and then you go and get hired by a studio like you did in the 1930s and get some like 10-year contract and you make movies every couple of years. I mean, it's really like being, you know, I tell people it's like selling oranges on the freeway. I mean, it's like, it's totally like day labor, you know, there is no continuity from thing to thing. Then you look back and go, wow, yeah, I've made all these movies, I guess I did, you know. So it was something that an instructor at Ohio State, looking at some films I'd made, you know, for fun or whatever you want to call it. I did these stop-motion animation films, these James Bond sort of parodies. They started out being parodies, and then as I sort of started making them, and I sort of got into the whole thing. So they didn't become more serious, but I took them more seriously. And he was like, oh, you're good enough to do this as a career. And I was like, really? Well, I'll take some film classes and see what that's all about. And then I got straight A's, and, you know. But it really hadn't occurred to me until he said that. He was actually a former student of my grandfather, who was actually brought to Ohio State to help start their audiovisual communications department before there was a film department. So it was something I was doing as a hobby. My mother thought I should take some acting classes to help, you know, open me up or whatever like that. And so I was always exposed to a lot of that, movies and stuff like that. But I just was in it as a fan. I never made movies because I wanted to be, you know, the next Stanley Kubrick, or I didn't have those kind of like, I need to be famous. The best way to be famous is to make a movie. That was never my motivation or intention.
Well, I mean, yeah, you mentioned Kubrick. When you were starting out, what were some of the films that you found, you know, to inspire you, that when you decided you wanted to make films?
Yeah, because there's a difference, you know, where even today there's certain kind of movies everybody sees or whatever, and, you know, you can skip over that part of the thing, although 2001 was one of the first films I remember seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like the only person in my family who liked it. And I didn't see the film again until many, many years later, and I was a very little kid. I mean, when I saw it originally, I was, I don't know, 7, 6, something like that. And I was amazed years later when I saw it again on projected, even when I was in college, how much of it I remembered. There was like one thing I'd completely gotten wrong about the movie, but it was just amazing how much I remember that. But, there was in Columbus, as you know, and they're doing kind of an online revival now, Fritz the Night Owl,
mm-hmm.
the late night movie
host,
for years and years. And then Channel 4 started running. They started running all the Universal movies late at night and all that kind of stuff. It's before you could, you know, record them. And we just never had cable. So I would, you know, even if I had classes, I would go to bed and then sleep for an hour or so and then watch the movie, you know, and then go to bed after that and get up and go to school through college if I had early classes and stuff. But strangely, like when I started actually kind of making movies, so I wasn't trying to necessarily, you know, make a career out of it, but I was making movies, so then you start to look at movies differently. And when you're shooting a movie, if you go see a movie or a TV show, you're like really aware of like, oh wow, it was raining that day, and so they would have had to do this or that, or you know, it's daytime or night, or it's really cold, or oh man, that was how did they get the camera through that little space? And, you know, when you're editing, you're always looking at the edits, you know, and when you're mixing, it's all about the sound, just totally. But a movie I saw, which I think is actually a pretty good movie, despite some sort of like, you know, after Psycho, like every movie had to have a dead person somewhere in the house. So it was part of the plot when somebody
right.
talked to a dead person, you know, who they just helped. And there was this thing on the news tonight in L.A. They, like, pulled over somebody who was driving around in the car with a dead person who was essentially, you know, Mrs. Bates. She's completely mummified. And
oh, for the
car driving around with, and the person's probably been dead for at least 6 months. So they've been driving around with this dead person in their car for at least 6 months.
That's crazy.
Anyway, this movie, this Curtis Harrington film called Who Slew Auntie Rue? I think actually it's Whoever Slew Auntie Rue. And I remember watching that movie for the first time and being aware of somebody out here when I mentioned this, because Curtis, I edited a film at the American Film Institute, and somebody, Curtis Harrington, was a teacher there. And I saw him speak a number of times and never actually got to speak to him. And he used to always go to films I would be going to also. But the sort of the force behind the camera or the director's choices of where to put the camera and stuff. And mm-hmm. I remember watching that, like, that's where the camera should be, or that's what I would have done somehow. I wasn't, it was just a very strange, interesting experience. That was when I was really starting to be aware of, you know, the director of the movie, you know, regardless of the psycho elements of that. And I think that movie actually is a pretty good film. So yeah, Curtis Harrington was one. And I would go through these things where I would discover these names and I would look them up in Maltin's book. Mm-hmm. And, oh, Curtis Harrington, what else did he do? And usually there'd be another, at least one other film which you'd seen, which he had done. And like, oh, I remember that. And you know, I'd go on these little binges of these different directors. I mean, Hitchcock I was really interested in, and Wells, you know, going into film school was really interesting because although I'd watched a lot of movies, I wasn't, Jaws was the film I saw that probably made me, you know, want to make movies in some kind of weird way. And a lot of people went to school with, like, there was, like, Star Wars. There's these movies, you know, a lot of people now, still Tarantino is the reason they want to make movies. So Jaws was that to me. So I would go through these whole phases of various, aside from just Hitchcock and Kubrick and Wells and some of these other people, like, you know, Richard Fleischer, J. Lee Thompson, you know, you see a couple of these movies and you start to go, oh, this person got this whole career, and you like open up, you know, go through the Maltin book and watch, go through the TV guides and, you know, just hunt down these movies. So there'd be these periods where I was fascinated by these different, you know, filmmakers, you know, trying to see as much of their stuff and kind of understand what they were, you know, what they were about and all that kind of stuff. I still kind of do that. I mean, I think it's kind of important to continue to kind of delve in and discover new people's, you know, approaches and craft and art.
what are some things that you have been excited about, you know, in the past few years? What are some either emerging things or some things you've, like, rediscovered? Or, I mean, do you think it's, I mean, do you get to go to the movies very often? Are there things that draw you to the theater?
Yeah, it sort of depends. I mean, you know, new movies, even in school, I used to argue with people about, you know, I don't know how many, like, new releases you need to see every year to kind of, like, keep abreast of the way things are, that it's, mm-hmm. your time is sort of better spent exploring things that aren't just out there, because, you know, new films are more alike than they are different. So it depends on the year, and of course, DVD and stuff allows you to, a lot of movies I saw as a kid or whatever, you actually see the way they're really meant to be seen, you know, even like Godzilla films and stuff, and they're all blown up, you know, you can see the scenes and everything because it was never meant to be seen that big and all exploded and large. So you kind of get to really see films that, you know, it's odd. You know, I mean, you can own them, which is kind of mind-blowing too. But there are things that, you know, that come along. I mean, you know, Coffin Joe, that he really fascinated me, like, just as that was sort of like starting to kind of explode out here in America. Gosh, who knows what, you know, the whole giallo, the Italian giallo things and all that stuff I was into. Ed Wood, I became kind of fascinated by, right, you know, a lot of these things I sort of caught right before they, like, caught on big.
Mm-hmm.
And various just little, like, niche foreign directors. I mean, there's, you know, the guy who did Funny Games, that director.
I
see some of his other films, that White Riband or mm-hmm. White Ribbon, I just came out on DVD. Who's some other? So I'm always kind of looking, you know. And I mean, out here in LA, it is a great place to be if you're a film fan, is because I have got to hear various people speak about films. Frankenheimer used to always show up when they showed his films for his places. He was somebody I followed for a long period of time. People I never thought I'd like. Some of them I've got to meet, but just go get to, like, hear them talk about their movies, kind of one on one, or ask questions and stuff, and see real prints of the movies and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it is kind of a living art, you know, in terms of, you know, that's changing now. A lot of the, you know, I don't think there's many people left who are making films in the 60s or even the 70s now. Mm-hmm. But, even, you know, if you went to school out here, which I did not or whatever, there was, you know, Ruben Mamoulian and these people who'd made movies very early on were still here. And so, like I said, it becomes a living art for you.
That's cool. Yeah, I just...
But I still love the repertory things and the stuff I haven't. You know, I don't like to walk down the same path repeatedly. And it hasn't, you know, gone through back through through various, you know, movies and rewatched them. And most of them hold up, which I think is good. I mean, I haven't gotten too bitter or angry. I still enjoy the same movie I enjoyed, you know, when I was, you know, whatever, I've seen that happen with certain people. They're like, I used to love that movie. Now I just think it's trash.
Yeah, you just watch it too much.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I just went and at a little theater here, William Lustig came and they showed the Blu-ray of Vigilante, and it was just, I mean, the quality was amazing. Even the, you know, parts that you weren't even able to see before, you know, it was
just kind of came alive.
And it was cool because a lot of people there had grown up in a lot of the filming areas and stuff, and he was there and they talked about it and stuff. So it's really awesome. I always like going to stuff like that, like you said, and getting that kind of perspective. Uh-huh. So that's nice.
They will say stuff that doesn't show up in print or other things too, and if the discussion is good, you know, sometimes you get some bad moderator and you just want to like, you're blowing the opportunity, and then you, but the moderators try and let be too clever or something. It's
right.
Kind of irritating. But yeah, it's you know, it's not something you get to do every day.
JunkFoodDinner.com is the world's oldest and sexiest website. Go to JunkFoodDinner.com for the latest episodes of the show. We also have all of our past episodes. You will also find news about the show, movie news, trailers, funny stuff, and links to our friends. You can also leave us log comments, because that makes us happy. We hope our website will be a good way for you to spend time during the downtime in life, when celebrities are not going hilariously crazy, and when the Warcraft servers are down.
I can't do it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live! Fucking thing sucks!
But,
Do you think that, not just the internet as a whole, but stuff like Netflix, sort of plays into that, like, gluttonous thing where you're not going to the video store and you're not picking out a specific movie. You're, you know, just scrolling through thousands of movies and you can just, you know, watch whatever you want. I feel like there's less commitment now.
Yeah, I think that certainly could be true. I wonder about that. I mean, or you know, like bookstores going away or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just like buy some Kindle and they'll just give you what they consider the books you should read.
But yeah, it's just not the same.
It's not as immediate for one thing. So in a way, it's kind of like either makes it more disposable or you just get stuff which you're not going to have right away. So it's not like you're walking through the bookstore or the video store and looking through all this stuff and going like, okay, well. I'm only going to watch, you know, two movies or one movie this, you know, the next couple of days.
Yeah.
What am I going to get? Means what are you going to watch right then? You know, that's gone. So it's like, oh yeah, this week I get some movies and, you know, I'll send it back when I get around to them. And so I think there is kind of a less commitment thing. It's also like, I don't know. I mean, I don't really think you're missing anything in terms of getting to like hold the thing yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you really look at the pictures or read the whole thing like you would if you picked it up? Or do you just kind of like see the little, you know, I don't know. You know, you just look for genre, new stuff on genre stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we talk a lot on the show about the merits of, you know, tangible media, and because we all grew up going to the video store and looking at these covers and getting them, you know, burned into our brain and reading the backs and, you know.
Oh, yeah, and then you, like, go back to the store and you're looking for the one that somebody's misplaced or stolen or whatever, you can never find it again. I should have rented that, and I don't know where it went, you know. But I don't remember what it was called. That had a green cover with a thing on it, you know. I remember being in a video store and some guy walked in one time and was like, yeah, I wanted to see this movie. It was about this guy. You know, like, what'd the box look like? It was like a guy's face with a gun on it. I was like, oh, man, that's like every third movie ever made is a guy's face with a gun on it. But the guy was serious. And, of course, it was just a hopeless thing. But, yeah, so, I mean, the whole thing now is like, the immediacy of it, if it was completely immediate, if you could just download it, I suppose that sort of changes it in terms of you could watch it right now. But, I mean, it may be part of sort of the whole piracy problem, which is a big problem. And some people were just talking about the idea of sort of intellectual property. Is just like, I think people who pay the money to buy the computer think that basically that they should be able to watch anything the computer can give them for free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know. I mean, my $10 movie or somebody else's $100 million movie or whatever are all just reduced to something you just, like, click on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, and actually the guy who made the lower budget movie has more to lose from you pirating his movie than the guy who did the big one, usually. Not always.
I mean, that makes sense. But there's, I mean, it's...
Right, it's yeah. And the other thing is, I'll go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, stuff that still doesn't have a, you know, a DVD release or even isn't, you know, available widely on tape, you know, you can find a lot of that stuff online. What do you feel the same way about that? Like, stuff that's not available or, like, way out of print or there's just no other way of seeing it. Is that something you would still say is no good? I mean, I would say it's sort of like tape trading, you know, before that kind of stuff was widely available.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd buy a lot of film music. You know, music was probably a doorway into film for me in a way, because it's certainly, you know, connected to film in a way that it's not connected to many other arts. There's, you know, opera and that kind of stuff, but that's different. But, and yeah, you end up getting bootlegs or trading things with people, which then when they come out, I've usually bought, you know. So it's a matter of, like, you get something for free because that's the only way you can get it. But when it comes out, you look at it, and if it's going to be better mastered or have the extras you want, if you really loved it, you know, you got it. You know, the loss there is that, you know, I mean, if you could never see it at all, that kind of creates these kind of holy grail things too. But,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the big problem with all that right now is it just, you know, as a filmmaker, it just pays virtually nothing for that kind of material. So to download it or stream it, it's like, it's even more vaporous. You know, if it's a video store, you do get your chance, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Other movie has the same genre or alphabetical listing. you know, your Avatar box doesn't take up any more space than your, you know, you name it, no budget independent movie you've never heard. They're all right there. You flip them over, you look at them back and forth, and you go, wow, okay.
And I guess I don't need to watch Avatar.
Yeah. So the window between theatrical release and DVD release is like virtually nothing now, which is, I think, a big mistake.
Oh, part yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's just 3 months or whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're going to, you know, I mean, they wiped out sub-run theaters and a lot of these kind of things. I mean, it is kind of, you know, are movies even more disposable than paperback books now in terms of, like, whatever shelf time you get? I mean, if there isn't even a shelf, then it becomes a matter of, is that good? Then you just scroll through a page and you're going down the alphabet. And it's like, but then what based on the title and who's in it? You know, the artwork can get so small you can't even really differentiate that.
Right.
So it's an interesting debate, you know, about tangible media or whatever. I mean, if it isn't something you actually own or hold or do something with, is there a real value to it? Of course, if you put it in and you really get absorbed by it and into it, then yeah, absolutely. You know, there's like beat up, torn in half old paperbacks and crappy dubs of things I recorded off the television. There's things I wish I'd never dubbed over. I was like, oh my God, that used to run on TV. I had this crappy version of it, but now you can't get it at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so for me, I would rather have, you know, like the beat up thrift store copy of something than just like a, you know, a burnt CD.
Yeah, yeah. So. But you know, I mean, burning CDs gets better and better. It used to be like bootlegs, the quality was so marginal that you had to really be hardcore to want to like own that album or whatever it was.
But it took 4 hours to burn a CD.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten so much better now, but you know, with Blu-ray and 3D, you know, they're always looking for some new way that they can do something that the boot people can't. And it is really, you know, I mean, watching these things, some of these movies, like at home, it is almost like seeing a print of it. Sometimes it's like having your own, you know, movie theater, some of this stuff. When I got my big TV and I got the Blu-ray and you put these things on, it's like, it's just remarkable. It does let you kind of experience them more the way you did when you really saw it at the theater.
Right.
But there is a difference, I think. It also drives me crazy that when they created an actual widescreen format, the lovely Japanese with HD, that they created this 178. It's not 185 and it's not 235. So it's this whole other animal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool, but it's not just square.
Right. But, no pan and scan.
Yeah, but now you've got this whole other, when you got to release your movie, now everything, they just want everything 178.
Yeah.
And everything you see in a theater is still mostly 185 or 235, but when it goes to DVD, it's 178. It's not the same. The difference is not that great, but people are like, oh, yeah, I watched my 185 movie. It's like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, you did it wrong,
yeah. When was the last time you saw a Letterboxd 185 movie? You know, since Bill Lustig stopped owning Anchor Bay, never, you know. So it's just such a weird world. The technology and all this other stuff changes just so fast now. But I think, I mean, I think there's something about being able to go to the video store or the bookstore or the, go buy a CD where you, like, make the choice and you take it and you've got it in your hand and you're picking what you're going to want to look at right then rather than if you can just kind of, like, load up the bin with a bunch of, you know.
Yeah,
so what did Netflix deem worthy of sending to me? You
know? Yeah.
I haven't joined the network's thing yet, so.
I have it. It's, I mean.
Then again, I guess, I mean, a lot of my movies are, you know, only currently, quote unquote, in print because of Netflix. So that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's definitely a double-edged sword.
I mean, I mean, Blockbuster still makes a lot of money. It's just that they, well, you know, not to go down this road, but the whole country's in this whole kind of tizzy over this whole kind of vaporous, you know, credit cards being used as money, which they aren't really, you know, and unfortunately a lot of people found out the hard way. it's part of that whole kind of ether, vapor, or e-ticket kind of experience.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, is there a certain discipline to, like, you know, choosing a movie and going and seeing it, you know, or buying a book and right then? Is it, you know, if you grow up with it and you just have the opportunity now to do it the other way, I don't, you know. Well, I don't know.
It's just
how that changes the things you really love or the things you, you know, can or do want to see.
Yeah. I just, you know, I remember, like, vividly wanting to see something and like going down to the video store and then it's not there. And then you have to, you know, you have to make the choice. You have to go through the aisles and you have to pick out something new. And that was always exciting and that was always fun. And now it just doesn't seem like you have, you know, you're not going to have that problem. And that
I do really wonder about that. Cause some of that has led me to discovering,
yeah,
you know, actors, directors, writers,
exactly,
music that you'd never heard of before. Cause you like watch it, you're like, ah, this is really cool. What is that?
Yep.
And then you go find out and you find a whole bunch of other interesting stuff. It may all not be as good. You may even find better stuff.
Yeah.
But because you were there and you grabbed that, yeah, I remember this guy telling me, it was like this DP friend of mine who shot Close to the Season saying, I watched this movie called The Hatchet Murders. Oh, you got to see it. Well, it's, you know, that's Deep Red. It's Dario Argento. I mean, that was how that whole, you know, I'd seen that box, Hatchet Murders. What the? I'm not getting this.
Yeah.
You know?
Not exactly so.
And, you know, look what was waiting, you know, behind that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I don't know. It's interesting you guys are actually, that there's actually a debate about that. It's something worth thinking about.
Definitely. And I think that so many people don't, you know, they're just content to just throw on whatever, you know, the Love Guru or whatever other garbage is going on.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I mean, I have this saying that, like, every movie ever made is both the best movie ever made to somebody aside from the filmmaker's mother or the filmmaker himself or herself. And every movie is the worst film ever made to somebody. I mean, I've rarely found a movie that doesn't have somebody on either end of that crazy spectrum. Somebody in the video store one day was like flipping through some things, a couple like, oh, Freddy Got Fingered. Oh, this is the best movie. and they were like, oh, this movie is the funniest movie I've ever seen. This is fantastic. I was like, yep, there you go, Freddy Got Fingered, you know.
Yeah, the best movie ever.
Best movie ever. So that's cool. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, it is a great evener that all these things can be sort of had on the equal footing.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, on the show, you know, we'll pick movies, and then if somebody doesn't like it, that's usually when the best shows are, is because we get to, you know, we get to, like, fight for our choices and argue why we think they're good. And I don't know, that's always when I think the show's the most fun.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's like, oh, it's great.
Somebody that really, yeah, I remember getting some vicious argument with somebody over Starship Troopers.
I love Starship Troopers.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was, I was like, because I'd read that book. I took the science fiction literature class in college. I was like, oh, really? Science fiction literature? Can you really take this and read it? And I thought it was a cool book. And so I was like, oh, this movie, they're going to totally, like, just pasteurize it all to oblivion. And instead, they just took the sort of edgy, out there elements and just totally made the whole movie about that. You know, the whole Nazism and the whole
stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Dirty Harry when I first saw it. I'd heard about that movie for years. I was too young to see it when it first came out and stuff. And I went in there and saw that movie. It's like, that was maybe the first movie that really made me aware of that. It's like, given the world that this movie creates, the way he behaves is the only way to behave, even though it's completely outrageous and the whole thing seems like set up to just, you know, drive people into a fury over things. but given the Starship Troopers world, that, those are the type of people who have to be there. So yeah. It's like, but yeah, I mean, this one friend of mine who just hated, I said, you know, I just said, you know, you realize that the movie is really like failing on the highest level. And I've had a few movies which I hate, which I think this is a completely legitimate movie. I just hate it because I hate what it says and how it's saying it and everything it's about. But that's, you know, few movies reach that level of like, but the, you know, cause this whole argument was just against that kind of society. I was like, well, yeah, but given that these bugs, how else could they act?
Yeah.
The filmmakers have set you up in a thing where, I mean, you know, you only get meaning through abstraction, you know, through like eliminating other possibilities. Can you pick what your meaning of your movie is? And meaning doesn't have to mean that it's, you know, going to change your life forever, but whatever the purpose of your movie is. And, if something can fail on that level, you know, there's not that many movies that totally, you know. And yeah, one person's junk is another person's gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, kind of how you look at it, and if you're really willing to defend it, or if you're just willing to kind of go with the crowd or whatever. Too many people just kind of go with the crowd, and people go see a movie and tell you it's great, and then after all their friends tell you it sucks, like a year later you hear the same person like bashing the movie. You know, I think it's a piece of shit. Weren't you the guy who called me up after you saw it and said I had to rush out? And see
you
it?
Called me crying.
Yeah. Or the other thing happens too. The new Rob Zombie film comes out. Oh, that was terrible. You know, a year later, the same person's like, well, I can't stop watching it.
Yeah.
Now. I worked in a movie theater. And the thing was that if you have to watch the same movie over and over again, you really do learn how poor, horrible movies get made. Because, you know, you watch a terrible scene enough times and it actually starts to kind of work or something for you. You know? Or you start to go, oh, that's not so bad. And, oh, this scene's actually pretty good. You know, I mean, it just kind of, it's like mind, the brainwashing, I suppose. You kind of realize how horrible movies get made because it's just sort of, you know.
Yeah, repetition works. I think that's probably how so many horrible movies get made.
If that's all you've got
to
deal with. You know, so that was kind of a good education for me.
I guess
What stuff does work and what stuff doesn't. But yeah, it's the lousiest thing ever if you're forced to watch it. You start to go like, well, you know, I kind of like that one scene. It's like, oh, Jesus.
On the same token, if you had to pick, what would you say is the worst movie you've ever seen?
The continue to be new lows, amazingly. And occasionally there's new highs too. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen one that I really. I mean, you know, the level of like something that's even a movie sometimes is just so shockingly awful. I mean, I always said that Plan 9 was not the worst movie ever made. That there's like other junk. Living in L.A., I've met some of these filmmakers in person at places, you know, at a party or various things, and they seem like coherent, rational, sometimes very likable individuals, but from watching their movies, you would think they were just, like, retarded, you know? It's just, you're like, I couldn't believe the guy who made this could stand up and walk across the room, you know, on his own.
Yeah.
And it really does kind of show you that whatever the proof is in the pudding or whatever you want to say, it just really stunned me, some of these people. I was like, some double bill or something. Oh, blah, blah, I was going to talk about the movie. You're kind of like, oh, well, I'll put up with that, or oh, it'd be fun to see what that idiot's like.
Yeah.
He's like a really nice guy, and you feel bad that his movie was terrible. and for me, I've just sort of come to tell people, it's like, well, you know, I'm sure they go home and they love their kids and all this stuff, but it doesn't mean they can make a movie. And so I still have to say I hate his films and he should stop abusing me. And then there are other people who make great movies who essentially, you know, should be locked up in jail or whatever too. But it's like, is the artist the person trying to make the art or the craft? I think that I was having this discussion with a friend of mine over something, and the thing he kind of came up with was Darren Scott, who's a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
The thing we sort of mutually came up with at the same time was almost like, well, the art is what the artist wishes he was really like. He's not really a gentle, coherent individual. He's got a mean streak or whatever, and you know that's kind of like, in some instances, they're sort of, you know, that's sort of the best that person has to offer. And sometimes I think maybe it's the worst they have to offer. You know, they're perfectly fine until they get up and say action, and then just, you know, get out of the way. But I don't know recently if I've seen anything I thought was just god-awful. I heard about this Manos Hands of Fate, which I've been unable to get through. But I was proud to finally own that movie.
Yeah, I've only seen the Mystery Science Theater version of that. So I don't know if I could sit through it.
I got about halfway through it. Yeah, it was pretty remarkably incoherent. But there's some of the worst movies ever being made or being made right now.
Oh, absolutely. And
some of the worst living directors are alive right now.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Just completely, like, personality-free swill, you know. there's movies I've stopped watching from certain people because I'm just like, oh, this is so...
Yeah, it's pretty staggering.
I remember somebody talking about a film saying life is too short. It was like, yeah, when it first did. Yeah, so I guess, you know, modesty forbids me from talking about... You know, which person I met last month made the new worst film ever made. Stuff people were released, like Lionsgate has just released things that, you know, these people could not graduate from even the most lenient film school. things which are just, they aren't even really movies almost. It's just shocking.
Yeah, it really is staggering to... You know, go to the theater and see trailers for stuff and just be like, oh, that was a joke, right? These are fake trailers. And then learn that you were terribly wrong and that they're coming out next month.
Oh, yeah, I remember watching the trailers for G.I. Joe and Transformers 2 back-to-back, and they'd cut out the green bands in between them.
Yeah, oh, so you just thought it was
like
one
the same movie. It was just the same movie. It's like, oh, these aren't giant guys? Because they're, like, flying around, and from the sky, the giant robots look the same size as the G.I. Joe guys did flying around.
Yeah, well...
I wasn't trying to be snooty. I was literally just sitting there thinking, like, oh, this is another trailer for they put two of the same trailer on, you know, accidentally after each other. This is like the B trailer. No, this is a different movie.
Yeah. Well, now that you've said that out loud, your dream of a G.I. Joe Transformers movie might come to fruition.
I think I finally hooked them up.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody somewhere is going to snap their fingers and say, that's it.
Yeah. A friend of mine wrote a G.I. Joe script, which never got made. Jean-Claude Van Damme was supposed to be in it. And these various people, it was like for years they were trying to get a G.I. Joe movie made. Just nobody could decide what it should be until they decided it should just be like Transformers.
Yeah. I thought Transformers were just
little toys. I didn't realize there was this whole mythology of the whole culture. So that was news to me. Still didn't make me enjoy the movie much, but I was like, no, I just thought they were little toys you could build into things. I didn't know there was any kind of story built into them.
All right, now listen up. This is the plan.
Scientific data reveals that all your friends are good for stealing your comic books and getting cigarette burns on your couch. That's why you need more internet friends. And we nominate JFD to be your new BFF. Like Junk Food Dinner on Facebook, and we can buddy up and chit-chat about bad movies and good movies and Corey Feldman movies.
Very intense. Obviously, have a lot on your plate at the moment, but are you still writing stuff? Are you looking forward to doing more stuff?
I am. Right now, I'm editing a film for somebody, even though I'm still trying to finish these other two up. I am looking forward to doing new stuff. I have some scripts which I'd still like to get made, and I am sort of anxious to, you know, get back and, you know, just write again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my answer is yes, I am looking forward to whatever that might be. There's several things I started kind of pushing around in a circle. But yeah, I've not got to sit down and write a whole feature script since starting on these things. And that's, you know, it's been 2 years now. So
yeah.
We closed the season, which stars Amy Brooks from the most recent Lawnmower Man movie and a number of other genre films and lots of stuff is in it. Joe Unger is in it also, who's in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, and Damien Maffei, who's a very good actor who I wanted very much to be in this movie. They are the stars of that one. It's with Artist View Entertainment, which is the sales rep for it. The movie is going to the American film market. They will actually have screeners ready to give out then. So they've said that there's been a lot of interest in it since taking it to Cannes. We'll cut a new trailer for that. There's webisodes up for that movie.
Oh, cool.
Online, which are pretty good. Some of them are more probably interesting for local interest people, but I've never really had anybody do webisodes. And they were edited. They're not just like me talking into a camera. That's day 10, and I don't think we'll ever be. I mean, those are, can be kind of interesting, frankly. But they had their interns actually edit the things together, and it gives you a good idea of what the scope of that film is. So that'll be the next one out there.
Cool.
Live Evil, the vampire film I did, is still out there, various places.
Mm-hmm.
I did that movie kind of came out as I was still finishing that up as I started these other two. So that film is the most recent release of mine. Beyond Dream's Door, you can still download through Amazon and various places. And Season of Darkness will be getting finished. We showed close to the season at several conventions. We showed it at Famous Monsters.
Oh, nice.
And also Monster Mania in New Jersey, and got really good response and had nice crowds for both of those shows. Both of those times, the movie was still a little bit of a work in progress, so it is totally locked now. Watch for close to the season, and Season of Darkness should be finished up, you know, early next year at the latest. We shot that on 35mm, and I'm going to finish a print of it, so we have a print or two to take some festivals and stuff. So that's
real cool.
Yeah. And that's the one shot in Columbus. I think both of these movies are a big leap up from my other stuff. Not to bash any of the other movies, but I think they're both big steps up for me.
Cool. Well, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing those. We'll probably try to get them on the show at some point when there's when they're available. So
right, and Ghost Lake's still out there, of course, too. That's probably and Unseen Evil were probably my most widely released movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned some lessons in Ghost Lake. I think this is better than that movie. But yeah, you can still find that.
Excellent.
That's there to be had.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you again for taking time out and talking to us. And
yeah,
it's been a lot of fun.
Let me know. Thanks for finding Beyond Dream's Door. I hope you've also found a DVD by this point. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. I bought the DVD online on Amazon. And,
okay.
There's a lot of great extras and stuff on there. So I was really happy.
Yeah,
the scores on there and stuff. I thought that was really excellent.
Oh, the what?
The score from the movie, like the soundtrack.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. That was that was actually recorded on like a multi-track video 8 deck.
Oh,
so like I had to kind of like, I could just barely get that recovered from its original source.
Wow.
Get on that disc. But yeah, I just a couple being that movie is something that's, you know, I hate to use the word special in a situation that's not referring to, you know, a character on South Park, but that movie has been kind of special to some people, and people like contacted me about that. You know, it took a long time for it to seem like anybody ever saw a film I made. It seemed like I'd almost been making movies for about 10 years before people started to come sort of back towards you. The internet was part of that. And initially very positive, and of course now it can be a very negative way.
Yeah.
But that, so, you know, there are some people who told me that was their favorite film, and that, you know, they saw it at a time when it kind of opened up their eyes to what movies could do, because they'd never seen a movie try to do the things that movie was trying to do. And so when I was doing that DVD, I was like, okay, well, you know, people who like this movie seem to really be into it. And I've loaned the movie to somebody who kept it for a very, very long time, and I figured they'd never watched it. And by the time they finally gave it back to me, they told me that they'd watched it 12 times. So they didn't want to give it back to me. And then I felt bad about asking for the copy back. But at the time, I only had a few boxed copies, you know. I was like,